Because of disobeying the orders of the Lord, duratyayam, very difficult, yasanam, calamity, na, not, ati, greatly, grigat, far off, tat, that, astu, let it be, kamam, desire without reservations, he certainly, agha, sins, niskritaya, forgetting free, may, mine, yata, so that, na, never, kuryam, shall do it, Huna, again, evam, as I have done, adha, directly. Translation. King Parikshit thought, due to my neglecting the injunctions of the Supreme Lord, I must certainly expect some difficulty to overcome me in the near future. Now I desire without reservation that the calamities come now, for in this way I may be free of the sinful action and not commit such an offence again. Translation responsibly. King Parikshit thought, due to my neglecting the injunctions of the Supreme Lord, I must certainly expect some difficulty to overcome me in the near future. Now I desire without reservation that the calamity come now. For in this way, I may be freed of the sinful action and not commit such an offence again. Purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. The Supreme Lord enjoins that brahmanas and cows must be given all protection. The Lord is Himself very much inclined to do good to the brahmanas and the cows. Go-brahmanya-hitaya-cha. Maharaj Parikshit knew all this, and thus he concluded that his insulting a powerful brahmana was certainly to be punished by the laws of God, and he was expecting something very difficult in the very near future. He therefore desired the imminent calamity to fall on him and not on his family members. A man's personal misconduct affects all his family members. Therefore, Maharaj Parikshit desired the calamity to fall on him alone. By suffering personally, he would be restraining from further sins, and at the same time, the sin which he had committed would be counteracted so that his descendants would not suffer. That is the way a responsible devotee thinks. The family members of a devotee also share the effects of a devotee's service unto the Lord. Maharaj Prahlad saved his demon father by his personal devotion. A devotee's son in the family is the greatest boon or blessing of the Lord. Amagyana timirandasya gananjana shalakya chakshura militam mena tasmai shri gurudeva namaha. Nama om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Shrimati Vedayananda Goswami Niti Namine. Nama om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Shrimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namine. Namaste Saraswati Devam Gauravani Pacharine Nevasesha Shunyavani Pashachari Shatarine. Vancha Kalpaturubhyascha Kripa Sindhavaya Vicha Patitanam Pavanevi Vaishnavaya Namon Maha. Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nichananda. Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasari Gauravakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So Srimad Bhagavatam, starting a new verse here. It's interesting, this section where Prabhupada mentions here the Supreme Lord enjoys that the Brahmanas and the cows must be given all protection. Just the other day we had a meeting from I'm involved with the Hindu community here in Victoria, and a couple of the members actually gave a summary or a report as to how, and some of you may have already heard about this, but in India there is a faction, a right-wing faction in India, that are promoting quite extensively cow protection within India, that they want to bring it up to a level again from previous Vedic history, which is a really powerful thing. And actually in some states they are banning completely the slaughter of cows in a particular state. Have you heard this? It's quite an amazing thing. And they've asked the devotees to actually be supportive of this move to increase cow protection throughout the whole of Bharata. This is another thing that they want to change. They want to change the name of India back to the name Bharata. So it seems to be, with the influence of the devotees and the progression of positive thought, that India is actually making some really progressive steps in this way. So now we're hearing the pastimes in this new chapter. We're hearing the pastimes of Maharaj Parikshit and how remorseful he is for his sinful activities. That being that he had harsh words and insulting words to this Brahmana, this pious Brahmana. So let's talk a little bit about harsh words and insulting words and that sort of thing in this situation, and especially in dealing with saintly or devotees. Harsh words or insulting words. You know, when we were children we had that saying, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Well, actually, that to a certain extent is not correct. Harsh words, insults and curses can actually hurt you. As I was mentioning the last time I gave class, that if we're actually very insulting or denigrating someone, that actually has an effect, a subtle effect on that person. That's why things like voodoo and curses actually, to a certain extent, work. For a materialist, it works. The devotee is protected by Krishna. But still, as we're progressing in our Krishna consciousness, that could still affect us. So negative things said about someone can actually affect that person. And so we have to be really mindful. We see the example in the media at the moment where bullying is a major thing. Bullying in school, bullying in the workplace, various types of bullying, both direct bullying and also indirect bullying. And the big thing at the moment is cyberbullying. So anything through the electronic medium, malicious bullying is a major thing. It's a nasty thing, and unfortunately it's bringing about difficulties within society, in that there are more and more younger people committing suicide because of this bullying effect. And so a lot of lives are lost in suicide every year, more and more each year. So it's something that we have to be mindful of. We have to also, in our preaching and in our teaching and dealing with people, we have to actually be aware of that. So there's this cyberbullying, which is really a destructive sort of thing, that now we have this media where we can contact anybody in the world, and you know, we can slander somebody and cause them ill will and so on and so forth, and everybody picks up on it. So we have to be really mindful. Some of the effects that it can have is that a person, upon having this bullying happen to them, these are some of the points that the government points out, is a feeling of guilt. Somebody may be directing something to you and say that you've done a certain thing. They feel guilty and they feel that it's their fault. They feel hopeless and stuck in a position that they can't get out of. You know, remember when we were going to school, some of us were also perhaps bullied at school. Can anybody remember a time when you were bullied? Yeah? And you felt stuck. You felt completely confined, and that there was no way out, type of thing. I remember one time when I was in primary school, and the kids were bullying me for some reason or other, and I became so upset that I lost complete control of myself. I was just so upset I couldn't control myself at all. And I was hitting everybody. I was just a completely radical little kid. I was just punching this one and punching that one, and the nuns had to come out. I was in grade four or something. But the bullying affected me so much that I became so angry that I became like a raging nutcase. And to the extent that it looked like I was possessed or something. You know, I mean, the nuns came out, they tried to grab me, took three nuns to drag me back into the classroom. As soon as they let me go, I ran up to the window and there were Venetian blinds. I ripped all the Venetian blinds down. Then they had to get the local priest in, and finally I calmed down. So this is, bullying can have such a major effect. I mean, when you think about it, bullying can even affect a person to the extent where they want to take their own lives, their own young lives. And so often we see on the news, beautiful person, you know, for all intent and purposes, they're really a good-looking, everything is going well for them, educated, and somehow or other, due to bullying, someone's envious of a particular person, so they write nasty things, they kill themselves. A waste of human life. So also they have feelings of being alone. No one likes me. Everybody hates me. Feelings that they don't fit in, or I'm not with the cool group. I want to be with the cool group. So this bullying goes on. Feeling depressed and rejected by friends and other groups and people. Ostracized, feeling unsafe and afraid. And stressed out, wondering what to do and what's going to happen to me next. So these are some of the points that have been described about bullying. So this is a major problem in today's society, especially with young people. So speaking ill of people, insulting people, being hurtful is a very dangerous thing. And this also can happen within ISKCON temples. This can also happen with us because we're still, our temples are a hospital and we're learning to become Krishna conscious. And so we come sometimes with baggage from our past. It's not like we come to Krishna consciousness and for some time, you know, all of a sudden we become pure devotees. So all of us are still conditioned and we're learning to become pure. So some of these bullying things may still be in our nature, especially sometimes if we perhaps have a position of authority. We like to lord that authority over other people sometimes. And that could be seen as a means of bullying. It doesn't happen often, but it can happen. And so we have to be aware of it. And if you find in your life, in our devotional career, that we're being bullied in some way or another by a particular devotee, being harassed, we have to actually speak up. All the government authorities always say that if you are being bullied, they say this throughout the schooling system, throughout our industry also, you have to actually speak up. If you hold it within, that effect can actually be so detrimental to you. So if you find that someone is actually unnecessarily provoking you or talking you down or treating you in a degraded sort of way, even very, very subtly, and you're feeling the effect of that, you should talk to someone about it. And within ISKCON, within our temple structure, we talk to the leaders of the society and we talk to our spiritual teacher and we tell them about the situation. You cannot hold it in. It is imperative that we actually express it to someone else. So this, and it can also be not only necessarily just in the temple environment, it can also be in the bhakti vriksha groups. You know, someone can lord it over someone else and utilize them in a way and harass them in a way. Or we also have it in Grihastha ashram. You know, someone is a little bit nitpicky on another person, one Mataji to another Mataji, one Prabhu to another Prabhu, something like that. So we have to be mindful. And somehow or other we can't let it fester. We have to be able to let it go and develop it. So the little Brahmin boy was harshly cursing Maharaj Parikshit. He caused him a great amount of concern. Now I wanted to talk a little bit about cursing. Cursing is an amazing thing. You know, we've all heard about cursing. So there are many, many stories throughout the Vedic scriptures about cursing and Mahabharat. I just wanted to read a couple of them. There was one where Arjuna went to the heavenly kingdom of Lord Indra. And Indra, to cut a long story short, Indra noted that when he was there, there were passionate glances between Arjuna and an exchange between Urvasi, who was one of the heavenly damsels there, during his stay there. And he commanded Urvasi to spend a night with Arjuna. So this was a pretty passionate sort of thing. However, Arjuna alleges that he heard of her relationship with his ancestor, Purva. And so she had the status in his mind that Urvasi was his mother, because a devotee sees everybody except their wife as mother and equal to Kunti Devi. So Urvasi was completely annoyed with this, and she cursed him that he would become a eunuch and live amongst women and sing and dance. So this is the power of a curse. Mm-hmm. Here we have this great Kshatriya warrior. I mean, these people were immense individuals, and Arjuna in particular was one of the greatest warriors there's ever been on this planet. He was huge. You know, he was built with muscle and power and very masculine. But this definitely heavenly damsel cursed him to become completely effeminate, a eunuch. So this is amazing. Now, upon Indra's request, Urvasi reduced her curse to a period of only 1 year, and which was the fate that became the 13th year of their exile, where Arjuna lived as Brihanala. So he was. That was the whole thing. So this is a powerful thing, that a person can do this. Another one was a famous curse from the Shastras. This was this is about Karna, again from the Mahabharata. Karna was again a great warrior, and he copped a lot of curses. Actually, there were two that I've noted. He was trained and became confident, and he learned from a Parashuram how to be a great Kshatriya. And he was his star pupil. Karna was Parashuram's, you know, Parashuram was a great warrior, and he wanted to be his disciple, so he became his star pupil. And the legend goes that one afternoon Parashuram requested Karna to bring a pillow for him to lie his head down in the shade of a tree, and Karna offered his teacher his lap. But while Parashuram was sleeping, a great bee or a great insect came and stung Karna on his thigh. So despite the excruciating pain, Karna did not move so as not to disturb his guru, right? So he's very powerful like that. He didn't want to disturb Parashuram's sleep. So the bee or the insect, whatever, just bored deeper and deeper into his thigh, just eating away. So you know what it's like if you've got a mosquito or something, right? And there's a mosquito hassling you, the first like, you know, or a spider or something. But the power of his personality, he just sat there because his spiritual master was resting on his lap and didn't want to disturb it at all. And this little monster was just digging deeper and deeper into his thigh. And Parashuram woke up by the blood that was trickling down from Karna's leg, and deduced at once that Karna must be a Kshatriya, because a Kshatriya was so powerful that they could withstand such pain. And he cursed him, and that he wasn't a Brahmana, because you know Parashuram wanted to kill all the Brahmins. So Parashuram swore vengeance against all the Kshatriyas, and so he laid this curse upon Karna. That he would forget all the mantras required to wield the divine weapon, Brahmastra. So this was again a powerful thing that he had been given, the most destructive weapon in archery, at the moment of his greatest need. So at the time of his greatest need, when he needed a Brahmastra, he would forget how to use it. Now, how did that thing go again? So this was his curse. So then Karna pleaded with his guru. Karna pleaded that any student would have acted the same way that he did And that in actual fact, he was the son of Vasushena, a mere charioteer, and not a Kshatriya at all. And the curse, and but while Parashuram regretted cursing Karna, he, in a moment of anger, his curse was irrevocable. He couldn't call it back. So he gave Karna a gift of a celestial weapon called Bhagarva Vastra, along with his personal bow called Vijaya, for being such a diligent student. So this was a sort of a compensation. Now there was another curse that Karna had, again from the Mahabharata, and according to the original story from the Mahabharata, Vyasadeva explains, Karna was cursed by a Brahmin. Again, the Brahmin cursed him for killing his cow. There was this old Brahmin who had one cow, and one day Karna was practicing his skills with a bow and arrow near the ashram of Parashuram, and one of his arrows accidentally killed this cow. Now, this poor Brahmin, I mean, his whole livelihood depended on this cow. So the Brahmin got angry and, due to Karma's deed, cursed him that he would become helpless in the same way that innocent cow had become by his chariot wheels getting stuck into the ground, that he couldn't move. So if you know from Battle of Kurukshetra, Karna's wheels got jammed and he couldn't move at that very point. So these are all very powerful curses on very advanced individuals. And the same is applied here. This little Brahmin boy can curse this great king, you know. So it's an amazing thing. A more contemporary instance is there. And there was this yogi in Jagannath Puri who was doing all kinds of nonsense. This was at the time of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, where he was a magistrate in the area. And this yogi had the power to make people sick and cause problems to family members. So what he used to say was, if you don't worship me and bring me Lakshmi, then I curse your family. And he was doing this all over the place. Now the police were dead scared to go and approach him, because he would say, you touch me and I will curse your family. So everybody was, hands off this yogi, he's too dangerous, you know. And so nobody would confront him except Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur put him in jail. Actually got the constables and said, I'll take care of this. Put him in jail. He physically went, he actually physically went with the constables to arrest this yogi. Otherwise they wouldn't have gone. I'm not touching him. So then the yogi cursed him, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and his family members. You attack me, you put me in a cell, I'll curse you and your family, you'll all die, you'll all suffer great illness and die. So in jail, the yogi kept blaspheming and kept blaspheming Bhaktivinoda Thakur, such that everyone was going to die. At one point he was frightened, as he was fighting the yogi in court, the Thakur, and actually his family started to get sick, and he himself was starting to get sick. So the curse was even acting on this pure devotee. But then Bhaktivinoda Thakur, during the trial, through divine realization, realized that the yogi's power was kept in his hair. He had matted hair, big matted hair. That his power was placed in his hair. So he told the constables to cut the yogi's hair off. And so they did that, and as soon as his hair was cut, all his power was gone. And within a very short time, the yogi died. And what happened was the curse was broken, and Bhaktivinoda and his family members again revived their health. So this is a very recent time. So this is an interesting thing when you're talking about the power of cursing. You know, we're skimming over these sort of things, you know, but this is an amazing thing. Just by word, by intention, by a focused attack of the mind, it can have such a huge effect. Amazing. So when we read the definition, the dictionary definition of what is a curse is a solemn utterance to invoke a supernatural power to inflict harm or punishment on someone or something. This is a curse. Through all civilizations, through all different cultures, through the Jewish culture, through the Aboriginal indigenous culture, you have In Aboriginal culture, you have pointing the bone at someone. In Aboriginal culture, if the shaman or the mystic within the tribe points the bone at you, then you think, uh-oh, I'm finished. So this is a curse. So this cursing is an amazing thing. Now, a qualified Brahmin has the ability to both curse and bless. So not only has a Brahmin, we've seen how these powerful Brahmins can curse people, but they can also bless people, both sides of the coin. So as we advance in our Krishna consciousness, we must become conscious of the power that a devotee has. This purifying process that we're in, this Krishna consciousness, actually makes us very powerful individuals. So we have to watch actually what we say and do. Say, for example, like a Brahmin. I don't know if it's ever happened here. I remember one devotee did it when back in the 70s when we were being harassed by a certain council member. One of the devotees cursed that council member and he wasn't seen again. And the way a Brahmin curses is, I don't know if the ladies do that, but with the men, if you have your Brahmin thread and you're so angry and you curse someone, you know, may you never take birth again or whatever, and you break your Brahmin thread, you're so powerful that you break your Brahmin thread, bang, that's the curse. So a devotee has to be really, really careful. But not only can a devotee curse, but they can also bless. And we have to see that we have to see that this is a real thing. You'll see it so often when Jayapataka Swami is here or Burajan Prabhu is here or one of these advanced devotees, you see people coming up for a blessing, to get some darshan, to get some prasadam, to get some connection. It's a very powerful thing. Even in my own humble way, when I go and do chaplaincy work, there are people in hospital that actually ask me to bless them because I'm a representative of the ISKCON Parampara and I'm there to help people. A lot of these people actually ask me to bless them. Now, I feel totally inadequate to do that, but by the strength of my spiritual master and the strength of Srila Prabhupada, I'm able to do that. And so we have to be really, really careful. So cursing... Can cursing be, now this is the interesting thing, can cursing be scientifically proven? You know, in this day and age, people want proof. People say, well, no, it's just psychosomatic. You know, you heard that someone was cursing you and you took it upon yourself and in a mental state you accepted, oh, I'm being cursed, and so, you know, we think like that. That's how the scientific community thinks. It's all psychosomatic. But we've seen incidences of curses where the person doesn't even know they're being cursed and the thing happens. So can cursing be proven scientifically? Can mere words and thoughts affect material things or people? It's a fascinating science. Is that a fact? And the fact is that our scientific community is full on into studying this. This is a major science now within the realm of science. The latest ones being, and they're all developing all over the world, quantum consciousness is really a factual thing. The principles of neural science, the power of the brain outside of the body. We have people, you know, there was in the 70s, we had this this guy called Uri Geller. And he, remember Uri Geller? Anybody remember him? Yeah. And he made a fortune just by bending spoons. He would get these little spoons and he would just hold the spoon and he would rub it, and by the power of thought the spoon would go and bend. Now that's all he could pretty well do, and that was his claim to fame. He could, by the power of mantra, he could bend this little spoon. So this is an amazing thing. And so there are scientists now that are studying this. Even in my own humble way, I was really amazed when I was doing the TM program. Remember, before I became a devotee, I was studying under Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. And he taught, again in the 70s, the TM Cities program. So you know Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, the siddhis, that you can be in different planets, you can read the minds of someone else, you can do this and that. So one of the siddhis that he taught was the flying siddhi, levitation. We were all very young, you know, neophyte sort of transcendentalists in a way, and they gave us this TM siddhi. So I just recently met with one of my old colleagues from the TM days, and he said, "Oh, I remember you, Bert," because I was Bert at that stage, not Bhakta. "I remember you, Bert," he said, "when you got that mystic siddhi, we thought we'd lost you. Because you were, you know, once you started repeating this mantra, you went into a trance that we couldn't get you out of. We had to drag you, clothes and all, and put you under a cold shower to get you back into some sort of consciousness." I said, "Yeah, I remember that." He said, we thought we'd lost you. And so then the next day, we were practicing this TM siddhi. Now, the TM siddhi was levitation. Now, most of us think, well, this is a psychosomatic thing. It's, you know, and to this day, I'll never forget. And even talking about it, I can feel the same feeling coming up. By the mere fact of repeating this mantra, the siddhi mantra, all of a sudden you feel like a butterfly at the base of your spine, like woo! And we had this room which was covered with foam, deep foam, 5-inch foam, and all of a sudden this urge of energy would go whoosh, and you'd go lift up the ground and down and jump all over the place. This was a factual thing. I mean, I wouldn't have believed it myself, and I wasn't, you know, I mean, I could barely sit cross-legged at that stage, but in a full lotus position, and you try it, try and lift yourself off the mat. But all of a sudden, this energy, this surge of energy, and boom, and down you came. So there's still just, and they talked to Prabhupada about it when this was all the rage. Prabhupada was told about these mystic cities, and Prabhupada said, "So what? A frog in a well can do the same thing. This is absolutely nothing, you know." So these cities are, these power, the mantra is a very powerful thing. And so there are these sciences that are currently in existence. One of the sciences is called notic science. Notic science. Have you heard of this, Mark? Mm-hmm. Notic science comes from the Greek meaning inner wisdom, direct knowing, or subjective understanding. Now, this notic science is the study of human thought and can how human thought can literally transform the physical world. So they're actually studying this. It's more than just a Uri Geller trick. That was nothing. What they're now studying is how thought can infiltrate other people's, you know, secret documents and so on and so forth, and can actually move things. There are people that can sit and they focus on a particular thing and the thing moves backwards and forwards, mm-hmm, just by the mind. So they've actually got machinery now, different instrumentation, where they can measure the potency of the mind, the power of the mind. So this is an amazing thing. So this is something that the Vedic authorities have known all along. I mean, we're reading about Karna and how he had the Brahmastra weapon and so on and so forth. So the Vedic culture had known all this all along, but now science is actually catching up. We've known about the power of mantra and prayer. We've known about this from Vedic culture for a long, long time. Just in regards to prayer, it was really interesting. Yesterday I had an opportunity to see a client that I've been dealing with for about a year and a half now. About a year and a half, 2 years, I've been visiting this young man who has been categorized a terrorist, and he was locked up in the remand center in Hoppers Crossing for 3 years. He's Sri Lankan, and he was supposedly attached to the Tamil Tigers. And so they locked him up, but they didn't know what to do with him. The Australian government thought, okay, if we send him back to Sri Lanka, they're going to kill him. If we send him to America, because America wanted him as well as a terrorist, they're going to take him to Guantanamo Bay and then eventually send him back to Sri Lanka and kill him then. So anyway, this man was in desperate, dire strife, and he didn't know where to turn. He had a wife and child here. He'd been supporting through his business the Tamil Tigers, and so the authorities in Sri Lanka wanted him to come back and stand trial, which meant that he was going to get killed. So at one point of time, he rang up and said, "Oh, Gyana, you saw Tulsi at one stage, didn't you?" Yeah. So at one stage, they thought, you know, he was just in desperation. And so he called the devotees, because he'd been to the temple one time. "Can the devotees help me out?" So I've been going to see him. Gyana went to see him a few times at this remand center. And all we could really say to him is just pray. Pray to the Lord and ask for protection. And understand that whatever will be the mercy of Krishna. And so he diligently chanted his rounds. He started chanting on beads every day, "Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna." I got a phone call when we came back from Europe. I got a phone call to say, "Oh, this is Tulsi." I said, "Tulsi, I was wondering where you were, you know." He said, "I'm now in a Maribyrnong detention center."
Amazing.
In Maribyrnong detention center. He's totally happy. He's completely happy. All the verdicts or all the judgments against him as far as being a terrorist have been dropped. He no longer has to go back to Sri Lanka. He no longer has to go to Guantanamo Bay. He had 3 weeks of reprieve. He was allowed out, and now he's in the Maribyrnong prison, a Maribyrnong detention center. He lives like a king there. He's getting everything that he wants. He only has to make application now for his permanent visa, and then he can live in Australia. And he rang up and he said, "I specifically wanted to just tell you that it's because of you introducing me to prayer and to chanting and to connecting with Krishna that this has happened to me." And he said, "I will be forever grateful to the devotees that I now have this opportunity. He wants to come to the temple as soon as he's free." So this is the power of prayer. The power of prayer. Very positive. So mantras are energy-based sounds. If you analyze what mantras are, they're energy-based sounds. There's energy, there's power behind that word. And you can understand that even in our daily dealings, you know. When you want to emphasize something to someone, if you raise your voice just a touch, you know, like if we're wanting our children to do something, or they're not doing something, you raise your voice and you say, "Hey!" And they go, "Oh, there's power there." So this is the mantras are energy-based powers. Saying any word produces an actual physical vibration. You felt that just then. Where there is vibration, there's bound to be a sound. So the activity which is called vibration in the Vedas and the Shastras has been described by modern scientists as wave theory. A wave theory. Now, our dear friend and devotee, because he was very interested in the Bhagavad Gita and had a great respect for the Bhagavad Gita, Albert Einstein, has proved that what we see in the world in the shape of trees and mountains, etc., are just another form of energy, another form of vibration. Einstein's also prepared a formula for converting these vibrations into energy. The truth is that the making of powerful atom bombs is the basis of this formula. So it's all to do with vibration. Thus the whole existence is nothing but sound, vibration. Mantras also contain sound. When uttered repeatedly with devotion, they become a source of enormous vibration and infinite power. So in Vedic astrology, we have that. You know, if a person needs to get well in a particular area or wants to learn some more knowledge, there are specific mantras that can be evoked to actually help. One instance, say for example, in India, which was a personal friend of ours, a Prabhupada disciple, she saw this factually. There was a person that was bitten by a cobra in India. And for all intents and purposes, it looked like they were gone, in Mayapur. And so then somebody said, "Oh, you have to go to this witch doctor or the local witch doctor," and he performed some mantras over the wound, and the person was alleviated from the poison of that cobra. So the ultimate mantra being, of course, the Maha Mantra. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So much power, power to deliver you from the clutches of this material world. This is the power of this mantra. So speech is the essence of humanity. Of all humanity, all of what humanity thinks and ultimately happens is determined by the expression of ideas and actions through speech and its derivative of writing. So everything emanates from the words that we speak. Everything the Vedas maintain comes through speech. Ideas remain unutilized until they are created through the power of speech. So you may have some ideas bubbling up in your mind, but it's only when you give it speech that it becomes a powerful thing. So mantras are a combination of words. Mantras are considered to be divine rhymes, meters, composed by the pure devotees of the Lord in the divine language of Sanskrit. When recited properly, they protect humans from different negative and evil effects. When spoken or uttered rhythmically and repeated, the mantras create positive vibrations which lead ultimately to the well-being of the person. As the Maha Mantra, or calling of the holy names of God, can free one completely from material bondage and return us back home, back to Godhead. This is the power that's been given to us by the Parampara. So our spiritual masters are saying, look, don't worry about any other mantras, whether it's a Ganesh mantra or a Shiva mantra, whatever other mantra, don't worry about it. You've got the Maha Mantra in Parampara. It's been given to you by a pure, unalloyed devotee of the Lord, given to you through the Parampara, and thereby it has potency. So you actually become very powerful by that. In the Vedas it is said that if you cut a tree, it can still sprout again. If you have two pieces of metal or iron, you can weld them back together again. But it also says that if you break a heart by venomous words, he was coming back to this using the negative aspect of words, by venomous words, there's no possibility to make it whole again. This is the power of negative, venomous words. Words can cause endless trouble, and also they can give boundless joy. So we have to be really mindful of that. And the reason why I'm bringing that up is because those of you that are aware of the news at the moment within our society, and some of us actually have to be aware of the news sometimes. As preachers, as teachers, we have to become aware of what's actually happening there. This is a big issue, this whole thing of insulting and harsh words. There's been huge hue and cry about the way our Prime Minister, whether we agree with her politics or not, but how our Prime Minister has been treated by insulting sexist words that have been coming out from all different quarters within society. And it's absolutely astounding and demoralizing. It's a horrible thing that is going on. Similarly, some of the emails and text messages that certain leaders within the army have been... Has anybody heard about this nonsense in the newspapers and that? Yeah. And it's all about what people are saying about another person. So we have to be really, really mindful. So even if someone has done something wrong to us, if somebody has insulted us, and if somebody has given harsh words to us, it is usually the materialist that will counteract by saying, well, you said that, no, I'll say this. You know, you called me that, well, I'll call you that. That's the normal reaction that a person does. But a devotee doesn't do that. A devotee remains equipoised. And we have to practice that. It's a natural instinct. You know, if someone says, oh, Bhakti, you're a big fat lug, you know, what? You know, you have to be really mindful to actually control ourselves. And we take that, we take examples of that in the Ramayana. In the Ramayana, Lord Rama was falsely sent for exile by the evil words that Kaikeyi and Mantara gave, right? That influenced the whole situation. So after his 14-year long exile, he came back to Ayodhya. And really realizing their predicament, Kaikeyi and Mantara realized, oh God, Rama's coming back. And how their lies and harsh words had set this whole thing happening, they became really worried. Because this is Lord Rama, and he's the king, you know. So the Lord paid respects first when he came to Kaikeyi. Before his mother, he went straight to Kaikeyi and offered his respects to her. No ill feeling, no harshness. He offered his respect to his dear mother. And then he spoke kind, consoling words to Mantara. Now Mantara was the one that influenced initially Kaikeyi to do the dastardly deed. But even there, Lord Ram was so compassionate to her and didn't have harsh words back to her. And in fact asked her to continue to live in the temple as was before. So this is the example that we have to take stock of, that we have to notice. This is how a devotee acts. So we can see how Maharaj Parikshit is sorry for his actions and is not retaliating to the little Brahmin. I mean, he's a little Brahmin kid. He's the great king. He could have just wiped him out immediately. But he didn't. He accepted it. He accepted his mistake. He had made a mistake. And the repercussions of that was going to happen in the activity that would happen. He now wanted that the reaction to his sinful act fall on him alone. This is what it says in the purport here. That he fall on him alone. And that he accepted the full reaction. So these words, this curse, he will accept it. And he didn't want his family to suffer in the future for his mistake. Interesting point that's mentioned here. From a materialist point of view, we have things called family karma. We have things called national karma. We're linked in with people. You know, the mistakes of our forefathers can come to haunt us even to a certain extent. But a devotee is free from these reactions because a devotee strives for Krishna consciousness and in constant service with the Lord. So, and there is the Narad Bhakti Sutra where it says, Ya karma palakarmani sanyas yati tato nirvando bhavati. And this is, who can cross beyond illusion? That person who renounces material duties and their profit, thus transcending duality. The purport that Srila Prabhupada gives is, as a devotee has faith that Lord Krishna will supply his needs. But this does not mean that he becomes lazy or inactive. He works for Krishna. And by dedicating all one's actions to the Lord, the devotee becomes free from karmic reactions. So it is by our service that we become free from our karmic reactions. That's how it happens. We don't, now this point of service is a really interesting thing. I was just talking to someone recently. There is a concept within the Hindu diaspora that service to God simply means that I do some puja. I'm doing my puja at home or I'm doing my puja at the temple. That's it. I'm doing my service to God. Prabhupada was emphatic that that is not what Krishna consciousness is about. Krishna consciousness means working hard 24 hours a day. Means working, physically working. Puja may be there, but it's secondary to service, actually working. So there's that saying by JFK, John Kennedy, President Kennedy. Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. He's famous for that. So our motto here in the ISKCON temples are, ask not what your temple or your guru can do for you. What can you do for your temple and guru? So there are many, many services. I was talking to Bhaktiman the other day. You know, we have a roster of deity worship. There are so many Brahmanas here within our community. And yet we're struggling to fill up the roster here for things that have to be done. Dressing the deities, artis, so on and so forth. Devotees, don't wait to be asked to do it. This is service, this is growth. If you can do it, you should do it. Knock on Bhaktiman's door. Prabhu, I'd like to do some service in the deity room. I want to bathe Jagannath. I want to do this. I want to dress Jagannath. I want to do arati. I want to do something. This is the method by which we clear our karma. Some people say just by taking initiations from the guru, yes, you'll take all your karma. That's a fact. But you have to work at serving your guru as well. It's a two-way thing. The guru says, yes, I will take your karma. And you will say, yes, but you have to do what I'm telling you to do. Now the guru is telling you, please work for Srila Prabhupada's mission. So we all have to work very hard. We have to keep thinking, what can I do for the temple? What can I do for my guru? What can I do to progress Krishna consciousness? What would please Srila Prabhupada? So we have to work. So devotional service is more than just puja. And as our society, and this is my personal view, as our society grows, we have to start working within the community on a social level. We have to start incorporating our devotional service out there in the broader community. That we're seen to do social welfare work with a Krishna conscious edge. This is our next area of focus. That we don't confine our devotional service just to the temple. That's important too. But that we bring our devotional service out to the public. Open more Crossways restaurants. Do more prasadam distribution. Do more book distribution. Do more chaplaincy. Do more helping people in the community. This is what's required. When we do that, the public will take notice of us. The public will say, gee, they're amazing people. Let me look at, you know, let me see what they're about. Because they're doing such wonderful things. Back at the turn of the century, the Salvation Army was considered a complete cult. A cult. Weirdos. Wearing these crazy uniforms and singing on the street with drums and everything. What are these people? They're nuts. That's how the Salvation Army was considered by the general public. Now they're considered as the most trustworthy, most philanthropic group on the planet. If you ask anybody, who do you trust? They don't trust politicians, they don't trust lawyers, they don't trust anybody else. Do you trust the Salvation Army person? Oh yes, we trust them. They're doing good work. That is our role as well. We have to be seen. Now the Salvation Army can only offer a certain amount of God consciousness in their teachings. We can offer the whole lot. Everything. The whole lock, stock and barrel. Prabhupada has given us everything. But we have to be out there with people, working with people. So in the future we're going to be asking the Bhakti Vriksha groups, members that are involved in Bhakti Vriksha groups, do something in your community. Work with the interfaith community. Work with social activities as a devotee. That they see you and they think, he's a devotee. Look at the beautiful work that he's doing. This is so important. I can't stress that enough. And Krishna backs that up in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 11, text 55. Mad karma kud mad parno mad bhakta sangha vrajataha nevihaya sabhabhuteshu yasamamiti pandava. My dear Arjuna, one who is engaged in my pure devotional service, free from the contaminations of previous activities, free from karma, and from mental speculation, who is friendly to every living entity, certainly comes to me. That's the ticket. We want to get back to Krishna. Now, Prabhupada says in that purport. Now, here is the verse which clearly explains the process by which one can attain success in spiritual activities, devotional service. As far as work is concerned, one should transfer his energy entirely to Krishna conscious activities. No work should be done by any man except in relationship to Krishna. This is called Krishna karma. The word matparama refers to one who considers the association of Krishna in his supreme abode as the highest perfection. As the highest perfection, that's what we strive for. Now on a positive side, as far as thinking, the power of thought and power, as mentioned here in the last part of the purport, family members share the effect of a devotee's service. So when a devotee really engages in service, his family members feel the effect of that service. Very powerful thing. To the extent where Prabhupada actually says in an arrival address in Gainesville on the 29th of July 1971, this is Prabhupada, and again it's mentioning here how in the purport Prabhupada mentions Maharaj Prahlad saved his demon father by his personal devotional service. In that arrival address, Prabhupada says, Nisringadeva was very much satisfied with Sri Prahlad. Here he is a pure devotee. But the same pure devotee requests the Lord, my Lord, my father was an atheist, and he was committed so many offences, so I beg that my father be liberated. This is Prahlad Maharaj's prayer at the lotus feet of Lord Nisringadeva. And the Lord Nisringadeva said, your father is already liberated because you are his son. In spite of all his offences, he is liberated. Hiranyakashipu, liberated. because of you as his son. Not only your father, but your father's father, your father's father's father, seven generations, they are all liberated. So if a Vaishnava appears in a family, Prabhupada says, he liberates not only his father, but his father's father, his father, his father, his father, and in that way. But that is the best service to the family, become Krishna conscious. This is an amazing thing. By you developing your devotional service, by losing your karma, by diligently following, you are making it possible for your family to go back home, back to Godhead. Sometimes, you know, in our conditioned state, we think, oh gee, I just don't feel like chanting today, you know, oh, I don't really care. If you think about your mother and your father, whom you love, most people love their parents, or your brothers, or your sisters, or your nana, or your pop. By you sitting down and diligently chanting your rounds and becoming Krishna conscious, you are saving them from a hellish condition of even rebirth. When they pass away, by your diligence in devotional service, all of a sudden they end up in the spiritual world. How did I get here? And the angels, the Gandharvas and the heavenly people that are in the spiritual world will say, well, you had a wonderful daughter and you had a wonderful son who was chanting Hare Krishna and became a devotee. And that was your ticket to come here. Isn't that amazing? Prabhupada says that. Lord Vishnudev says that. You can liberate your family members. You can save them from this repeated cycle of birth and death. So if sometimes we feel depressed about chanting, I don't really feel like chanting my rounds, think about your loved ones and do it for them. This is the potency of a mantra. This is the potency of the Maha Mantra. It not only destroys your sins, it not only liberates you, but this mantra is so powerful that it's liberating 10 generations before and after. Even your children's children's children are going to get the benefits of you chanting. This is amazing. This is so powerful. This is what we've been given. So there is a great advantage to having, as Prabhupada points out in the last sentence, there's a great advantage to having a Krishna conscious child, girl or boy. So we must train them well in devotional service right from the start, in their early years, in love and devotion. Teach them about the wonderful thing of Krishna consciousness. And that's the greatest benediction and the greatest benefit that a parent can have, to have a Krishna conscious child. So I hope that we all take that to heed. I'll stop here. Srila Prabhupada ki. Any comments or questions at all, Prabhu? Yes, Prabhu.
So please told me to go and approach on Mataji. And I went there, and now she was doing something inside. I don't know who she, but I understand that Mataji was doing something inside that Tulsi Mataji. Mm-hmm. And then I just went there, I just standing there, and I said, excuse me, I just said that. And she just yelled at me, don't touch the door. And then I didn't expect that Mataji to turn up and ask me. Almost with tears, I decided I walked away. I came out and then I told the priest, see, I'm not going to come to this temple. Why did Mataji behave to me? I'm sorry to say that.
No, it's good that you say that.
I said that, but today, you know, it would happen anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And just saying that. So I'm not going to come to the temple. Why did it happen to me? Because this place should be so humble and so thing. So, and then the priest told me, no, it's all human here, but something could happen to anybody, so just relax. Why should I not? It doesn't matter. Lord Krishna. Doesn't matter. I will come again. And then I said, Tulsi. She just said to me. So that's why I'm so attached to Tulsi every. So I started coming every day.
Amazing.
It's really, it's helping a lot. Helping me a lot again.
Thank you so much for that, Prabhu. So again, we have to be mindful. We hear this story, you know, of the power of words. Any other comments or questions? Somebody else? Yes, Prabhu.
Prabhu, you were talking about how these are also looking into the field of curses and subtle effects of speech. And what are these? Did the word properly? Quantum something?
Yeah, quantum science.
Quantum
physics. And Noetic. Noetic. Look it up. Noetic. Noetic. It's very interesting. Yes, Prabhu?
Interesting how Maharaj Parikshit is thinking that he was neglecting the instructions of the Supreme Lord, just in the same way you're telling us that we should be careful on cursing, that there is reaction for it, that Maharaj Parikshit engaged in that action, knowing that there's going to be a reaction. I mean, I was sort of thinking why Maharaj Parikshit didn't go back to the Brahman and beg his forgiveness. But he must have thought that this was, that he was being an instrument of the Lord.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah. For a greater thing.
But generally, the devotee, if he does perform some curse to another devotee or somebody, will try to go back to that devotee and their forgiveness.
Yeah, that's the proper way. It's interesting, just on another point on that Noetic science, they are actually studying all the old scriptures. They're going right back to the Rig Veda and all the different Vedas and analysing. And most of the realisations they're having are coming from the ancient scriptures. And they're giving credit to that and wondering how that can all fit in and analysing. So it's really amazing. Yes, Prabhu? Did you have a question? No? Okay.
Is there experiments with water?
Like
three different people, three different gods and four different gods of water, three buckets of water. And you're showing them, they analyze the water under a microscope and freeze it. And the water has had positive thoughts, it has beautiful patterns.
Yeah.
The water has negative thoughts, it has really horrible patterns.
Yeah.
And even though water that was just ignored, has also had negative patterns.
That's right.
And you can show water has consciousness.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing when you see that? So you can understand then the potency of prasadam. If just a positive thought on water can have that effect, where the molecules line up and it's in a positive structure, when we actually offer food in those powerful mantras, and especially the Maha Mantra, how that transforms the food into a spiritual, nourishing foodstuff, it's just like absolutely amazing.
I should say,
prasadam. Yeah, see what happens. Offer it to Krishna. Yes, thank
you. And we're thinking that link on how when you or when someone speaks negatively to somebody else, that affects the other person.
Yeah.
Can you speak a little bit on how when you speak negatively to somebody else, how it affects you?
It can also.
Your consciousness.
Oh, yeah.
That you're holding the negative thing because you're still dwelling on it.
Yeah, exactly right. You're exactly what you say. You hold on to it. And it has a poisoning effect on your whole system and can actually be totally debilitating, especially what they're seeing now also is negative thought can actually have a gross manifestation in things like cancer, you know, by holding on to negative thoughts, by holding on to negative ideas, it can actually develop into an illness, and they see that cancer can be brought about by holding on to negative thoughts. Not only cancer, but other illnesses as well.
What is the record? What is the record? How do they record from there? In case they have been in mind, somebody cursed.
Yeah.
So how do they record? Just chanting Hare Krishna.
Absolutely. That's the power of the Maha Mantra. But also using your intelligence as well. Using your intelligence and dedicating that in service to Krishna. Using everything in Krishna's service. Understanding you're an instrument of Krishna. And as I said in those purports that I wrote in those verses, by engaging like that, then the karma disappears. Yes, Prabhu?
With cancers and the mind, we were discussing here in the last 5 minutes, disease. Obviously, we have medicine, but if you look at nature, everything's different. For example, you go down the beach here and the tree is bent over. or, you know, like you've seen that windswept tree. Because we're conscious and aware of that suffering, why do we, when we have so many holy texts that it teaches to accept death, why do we, in our discussions after presenting these scriptures, talk about ways to alleviate death? You cannot push away suffering. Why do we bring that to a superficial level of cancer or other heart disease or whatever, without touching the deeper subject matter of accepting the ephemeral?
I hear what you're saying. That's a very good point. Any other comments or questions? Yes, Prabhu?
Reading the Mother's Heart says that if you have a negative thought about somebody, it actually comes back and affects the person who's had that negative thought. It doesn't actually affect so much the person who's directed, so it actually is going to come back and affect the person who actually gives out that thought.
Yeah. So. Yeah, that's a good point too. So let's stop, Prabhu. Srila Prabhupada ki, Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Gaura Premanandi.